This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Pleased to kick off this series on the Eightfold Path, and I thought I would start by describing a little bit of the background of what is the Eightfold Path and the structure of the whole path so that you can, hopefully you can attend the whole series, because this is an absolutely fundamental part of the Buddha's teaching, as you probably know. This teaching of the path, in fact, comes from the Buddha's first Dharma talk called the First Turning of the Wheel, when after he sat and after practicing many kinds of practices for many years, he sat and finally he had this realization of the way to freedom from suffering. And when he came out of that, he ran into some old ascetic people who'd been practicing with him, and they said, "Wow, it's just radiant. What are you?" And he said, "I am awake." And then they went off to this deer park where he gave the first Dharma talk, which was the Four Noble Truths. The fact that there is suffering. You know, it's so satisfying to me that this is the fundamental problem that we're looking at. You know, yeah, right, that's what everything, most human endeavor is trying to avoid suffering or fix it or find happiness, however you want to phrase it, one way or the other. So the first noble truth is there is suffering. Life, there's change, there's loss, there's death, there's things not getting what we want. The second noble truth is that there's something in the way that we're relating to experience that is actually the cause of what the Buddha calls suffering. And he identified that as with the word translated as craving or clinging or grasping. Basically, when we struggle with what's happening and think that we know how it should be and that we have the power and we ought to be able to make it be the way we want to, that's what causes suffering. And so we can learn to work with that, then there is an end of suffering. So the end of suffering is possible. And then the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, the way to the end of suffering. So the beautiful thing about the Eightfold Path is that it's both the way and it's the goal. So it expresses, it's sort of like a way and a path that we're an orientation that we're trying to learn to align ourselves with. And the more we practice aligning ourselves with that way, the less we suffer. And then finally, if you reach the end of suffering, you're just kind of automatically living your life in the way that's described by the Eightfold Path. So traditionally, the path is thought of as divided into three sections. The three basic aspects of the teachings, I'll just mention the Pali words because I like them. Sila, meaning ethics, morality, samadhi, meaning meditative calm and insight, or meditative training the mind, calming the mind, and then wisdom is the third, panya, wisdom, sila, samadhi, and panya. So the ethical foundation is really the bedrock of the practice. This is one of the key insights of Buddhism, is that you can't really settle the mind and have the deep calm that leads to insight without leading an ethical life. It simply stirs up too much inner conflict for you to ever reach that level of calm, because something in us is intuitively understands the benefit of ethical behavior. And so, you know, it's the basic understanding that every action that you do produces some kind of result, whether it's a result in the world or whether it's a result just reinforcing your own inner tensions in some way. Everything. We might, you know, maybe you can kill an ant pretty easily, but if you really look, you're just reinforcing that subconscious tendency to kind of harden up and look away a little bit, you know. So just even that little bitty bit of reinforcement is showing that each action actually has some result. The second training then is samadhi, training the mind through meditation, calming, working to let the mind let go of these deeper and deeper layers of mental irritants and really discover and touch into that happiness and bliss that begins to be a more than adequate substitute for all the things we think we can get in the world. And then finally, there's deep insights are possible into what, how is it that we misunderstand this? How is it that we keep thinking that we have to grasp it and make life hold still and be just the way we want it to be, and that our point of view is somehow the point of view that the whole world should conform to, and that when we can't get that, we're somehow missing out on happiness. So as the deeper that we settle and the more carefully we observe the comparison between acting out of some kind of clinging and grasping or really being able to deeply let go, then we have deep insights into, oh yeah, you know, life is constant change, I'm not the center of the whole universe, and it's a lot less suffering to go with those views than to go with the opposite views. So the path is a spiral. So the normal order of the path is not actually the order that you're going to be studying it in here, but I think it works fine the way it's, because it's not, it's more like an, it's been described as an 8-lane highway, you know, that all, you're working on all these things at once, and there, it's a, or an 8-sided diamond that where they are all aspects that interact with each other. And but I also like to look at the way that it's laid out traditionally, where it begins with wise view, goes on to wise intention, and then the three ethical factors of speech, action, and livelihood, and then the three mental cultivation factors of effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So I think of it as kind of like an engine of integrity that's going on all the time. Whatever we believe and whatever our deep viewpoint is really influences what is our intention. What are we going to do? And out of that comes speech and action and our choices about livelihood. And then when if we don't practice, that's it. That just goes round and round and round, and our view that I'm the center of the world and everyone should agree with me gives rise to certain intentions, and there comes our speech and action, and that reinforces our view, and there we go. But if you somehow get on the path and add in the mental cultivation factors of effort, mindfulness, and concentration, then you begin to see through that, and then it becomes a wiser engine that really, as your view gets wiser, your intentions get wiser, your actions get wiser, your meditations get more pleasant, and it becomes an upward spiral towards freedom. So, but it's not really linear, because all these factors influence each other all the time. You can't really do any of this without mindfulness, right? You have to start to pay attention to some of this. One of the sutta passages says that view, effort, and mindfulness circle around each path factor, kind of giving it life. And then, of course, there's intention that's operating in every moment. So actually, speech is a very good place to start, because it's something that's really obvious in our lives, and it really causes a lot of suffering, so much suffering arising from how the mind interprets sound waves, right? I mean, when you think about it, it's a beautiful example of really understanding the mind and the body. You know, this physical activity of sound waves comes in, the mind makes something out of it, and man, do we suffer over what we interpreted, what we thought they meant, right? What was said. It's just huge. There's a funny quote from Suzuki Roshi, who is the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. Somebody asked him, what do you think about the American students, I guess back in the hippie days this was? And he said, well, they all seem to be enlightened until they open their mouths. So speech kind of gives us away about where we're really at, you know, because it's a great way to see the mind and the body acting together, because it's hard to have speech not reflect the real state of your body. You know, a lot of physical tension comes out in the way people talk and the tone of voice. Your emotional state is reflected in how you speak. And then, of course, it's all interpreted by the mind and mediated by whatever structure of mental categories we have that we're trying to express in language. And it's a great laboratory for seeing how all the other factors work together. So, and seeing how the sila, the ethical factors, relate to wisdom and mental cultivation. You know, so if you've just gotten yourself all agitated and a speech is often right at the center of some difficult conversation, or, you know, we can carry speech over into writing and emailing and surfing, reading things on the internet, listening to TV. All that speech-oriented input is very agitating and can be very hard to settle, you know, if you've been indulging in that kind of use of speech. And also, it's a real insight into where are you coming from? What's your motives? Why are you saying what you're saying? So let's look at one more thing I wanted to say about the Eightfold Path. You'll often see these things called right speech, right view. That can be a little, whoa, you know, who knows what's right view. So one way, I actually like the translation of wise better. And the thing to bear in mind that it is what it really means, this word samma, it means appropriate. It's the best for the purpose of overcoming suffering. So it's the view and the way of using speech that's appropriate for this purpose of overcoming suffering. So the definition of right speech from the suttas, what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, from divisive speech, from abusive speech, and from idle chatter. This is called right speech. Sounds easy, but... So let's look at these factors a little bit. The whole idea of not lying and speaking the truth is really fundamental. You know, the Buddha, there's a story of in all the Buddha's past lives, through all the times he was different kinds of animals and all kinds of stuff, that the legend goes to working his way toward being the Buddha. It said that he said that he never broke the precept of lying. That was the most fundamental thing. So why would that be? I think it's important to understand that it's just that it's kind of the opposite of what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to wake up and see the truth of things. And so if you can deliberately lie, then that just goes right against what we're trying to do with this practice. So I think that's why it has such a central place. And also, though, the whole idea of what is the truth, you know, that's very interesting. It leads to a really deep inquiry and realizations about the relativity of different points of view. You know, Buddhism is really not very big on taking seriously a lot of abstract categories and arguments about who's right about all kinds of political and theoretical issues. It's very practical and down to earth. So it actually is not usually referring to that kind of truth, but more like what is the truth that you can discover through mindfulness in the moment of what's actually happening and what's right in front of you and what's happening at the senses. So without getting into worrying about the truth in terms of abstract arguments and generalizations, we just keep returning to what's happening and how honest can we be about what's happening. And then there's just the straightforward meaning of don't intentionally lie or mislead. Don't know one thing, don't believe one thing and say another, you know, for the purposes of some kind of self-centered gain. At this fundamental level, there's an interesting teaching. You know, the Buddha had a son named Rahula, who ordained very young as a monk and came to learn things from his father. And one of the famous teachings to Rahula had apparently lied. It doesn't tell the story, but the Buddha calls Rahula up and says, see this little water pitcher, and he pours it over, and see how empty it is. This is what's left, this emptiness is what's left of the virtue of anybody who would tell a deliberate lie. And then he goes through several more admonitions of not to deliberately lie. So again, it's really central. And one teaching I've heard that's very helpful is just try not to lie to yourself, you know? Just that's the first step, is to really have a deepening commitment to understanding what's going on, you know, seeing through our defenses and seeing through our tendencies to deny and not look at things. So really being a commitment to really not to, you know, slowly uncover all the ways that we kind of dodge and deny how things are. When it comes to telling the truth in terms of telling the truth to others, it gets a little trickier. There's another teaching called the Five Keys to Right Speech. Some of these are similar, and some it's got some interesting features in it. It says, it is spoken at the right time. And that is so important. It's spoken in truth. It's spoken affectionately. It's spoken beneficially. And it's spoken with a mind of goodwill. That timeliness is so important. You know, there's kind of a feeling in the psychological Western scene that, you know, gives the telling our truth, it gives rise to a lot of sort of emotional venting and dumping, and that we have to tell somebody exactly what we think right when we think it, and that's the meaning of telling the truth. So there's an interesting article. I've been studying some of this psychological technique called focusing, and the founder of that technique has an interesting article where he contrasts what he calls fitting in and pouring out versus relating. So, you know, we might think that there's only a choice between keeping our feelings and our thoughts to ourselves and only saying a little bit, but then that gets so, you know, kind of heated up after a while that then we just dump on somebody and we just need to express what we're saying as if there's only those choices. But there's this much more interesting possibility of actually learning to relate to someone and viewing communication as a two-way street. And the interesting thing about that is one of the points he made is that what you think you say is one thing, but what you've really said is what was heard by the other person. And the other person has a whole different, or at least somewhat different, internal network for hearing things and implications of words, and they're in a different mood, they're in a different place. So to really want to communicate is a much more subtle thing. And what's interesting, as this article says, is that as we look for another way to convey, if we really are, we say a little bit, and then we try to figure out what was heard, and then we try to find a way to restate it, and we go back and forth. And as we look for other ways to convey it, we can't help needing to investigate further about what we really meant, because we might realize that we said it in a way that had a little edge of hostility to it, or a little underlying agenda that, you know, the other person could not help but take offense at. And maybe we weren't so clear on what we were really meaning to say, and so we start to work on it. And then he says, soon, instead of working primarily on the other person, as if we need to fix them so they understand us, and only now and then grudgingly seeing our own part in these difficulties, we can become primarily interested in our own part in it, in our own business, in our own development. And then a whole new mode of living opens up and a lot of desperation falls away. I really like that, because you really, you know, you can use your own internal process of inquiry and mindfulness and speech. You can use this reflective internal inquiry to really try to express to yourself, what do I feel here? What's going on here? And it really becomes a very rich area of inquiry that takes a lot of the pressure off just needing to, you know, blurt out what you might consider the truth to somebody else. The Buddha has another way of talking about safeguarding of the truth, which is just simply prefacing where you got it. So there are, I don't know if I have this quote with me. It's from a wonderful sutta, but he says there are five ways that people come to have opinions. You know, a conviction, you're just convinced of it. You like it. It's the tradition. You heard it from your teacher. You reasoned it out by analogy. Or, you know, agreement by pondering views, which is kind of similar. But if you just preface, you know, here's what I believe, or I've heard this and I like it, you know, and that's why I'm saying it. That's a truth-preserving way of speaking about the whole world of opinions and theories on different things that leads to less stress than just saying, this is how it is. When you really need to say something difficult and you really believe that it's true, that timeliness, you know, that your own heart of goodwill and the question of timeliness really comes into play. Can it be heard right now? There are many opportunities to say many things to many people, but if it's not going to be received in a way that's beneficial because it's not the right time or because they can't hear it, then you might as well say it to a wall, right? And so go and say it to a wall and wait a little while until it's more timely and beneficial to say it to the person that you want to say it to. I came across this wonderful quote that I hope I didn't lose here on the floor from the French philosopher Pascal. It was on the somewhere on the internet the other day. He's talking about when we wish to correct someone else's opinion. We must notice from what side he views the matter, for on that side it is usually true, and we admit that truth to him. But then we reveal the other side from which we believe it's false. And if he sees that he is not mistaken, but he only failed to see all sides of it, then he's less offended. And I just thought, oh, that's true, you know. So if you can see, if you really can put yourself in the mind of the other person and see why do they say what they say, there's some reason behind why they said what they said. And if you can appreciate that, then it's much less head-on offensive to point out that there's another side to it. Sure, you know, from what you thought of so far, that's true. And it's much less threatening, as Pascal goes on to say, it's much less threatening to believe, well, I didn't see everything, you know, than to believe, oh, what I saw was wrong. You know, it's very scary to think your own perceptions are simply wrong. And if you meet somebody head-on like that, you're going to get a lot of resistance. So reassuring people that, yes, from the point of view that you saw, and we are all an individual point of view on this universe. You know, there have been so many experiments in terms of what people see being radically different from the different ways that they attended, the different ways their mind works, completely different. So then he also makes the point that people are generally better persuaded by the reasons which they themselves have discovered than by those which come from the minds of others. You know, so leading people to discover for themselves what they can discover. Eloquence persuades by sweetness, not by authority. It's a way of saying things so that those to whom we speak may listen to them without pain and with pleasure, so that they feel themselves interested, so that self-love leads them more willingly to reflect upon it. So I thought that was very lovely. So besides truth, there are these other factors, not harsh and not divisive. Well, harsh and divisive speech is, you know, a lot of what goes on in our public discourse on the internet and talk radio. It's very easy to find harsh and divisive speech. And I'm surprised to see how much of that has settled in to my mind in a kind of sarcastic way. I don't want to talk that way, but when I listen to myself, there's a lot of that that's a little bit of a sarcastic turn on it. That's kind of the way I'm talking to myself a lot of the time. And I'm really surprised to see that. So really look at how you talk to yourself and what your mind is, you know, little comments, little turns of phrase that you might have picked up from the world of sarcastic politics, you know, that have kind of worked their way into your mind. And, you know, become aware of that. Become aware of the tone of voice. And can we stay mindful when we're speaking, mindful of our own physical tension? And really the question is, where are you coming from when you speak? And you can feel that almost physically, you know. Are you coming from some need to just put this angry, harsh spin on it? Or are you coming from really from a place of considered silence where you've had a chance to notice what's behind what you're going to say? You know, there's a lot of different energies and different kinds of humor. You know, there's ways to be funny that are really quite harsh and mean, and ways to be funny that are more soft and gentle. So not being divisive, that's interesting. Not using speech and talking to people to try to create sides. You know, there are times when we have to talk to something about our relationship with somebody is really bothering us and we want to talk to a friend about it. There's a way of doing that that's really trying to create sides, you know, you and this person against that person, and then you might go talk to that person and it's you and them against the other person. And, you know, we can engage in that. But it's a whole different thing to really be committed to trying to look at what is the purpose of bringing up your difficulty with this other person, with a third person. Is the point really to come to an amicable resolution of the situation? Or is the point to create sides? You know, so you could be asking your friend to help you understand a third person, or to help you see a different point of view, or to help you find a way to express your point of view that's more wise. And all that is very different than just, divisive speech. This divisive speech has been going on for a long time. There's a quote from the suttas. I'm afraid I spilled my papers here, and not so easy to find things at the moment. What he has heard here, he does not tell there to break those people apart from these people here. What he has heard there, he does not tell here to break these people apart from those people there. Thus reconciling those who have broken apart or cementing those who are united, he loves concord, delights in concord, enjoys concord, speaks things that create concord. You know? So really look at how is your speech intended to create harmony or intended to create sides and sects and divisions. And there's a potential, of course, combination of divisive and harsh when you get into debating abstract concepts and theory and politics and religion and all those touchy subjects. There's another really, to me, kind of funny quote. The Buddha says, "Monks, do not wage wordy warfare." The monks are addicted to debates such as these. You understand this doctrine and discipline. I'm the one who understands this doctrine and discipline. How could you understand this? You're practicing wrongly. I'm practicing rightly. I'm being consistent. You're not. What you said first, you should say last. What you said last, you should say first. What took you so long to think about has been refuted. You've been overthrown. You're defeated. All this way of talking that's been going on apparently for 2,500 years when people get together and start to argue about things. So this can be harsh and divisive, and this is just amuses me that it's been going on for so long. The final of the key factors to avoid is avoiding idle speech, which is sometimes translated as gossip. There's a wonderful word for this in Pali, I can't resist telling you, sampapalapawada. So, no sampapalapawada. And in case you wonder what's included in that, here are topics that are to be avoided. Talking about kings, robbers, ministers of state, armies, alarms and battles, food and drink, clothing, furniture, garlands and scents, relatives, vehicles, villages, towns and cities, the countryside, women and heroes, the gossip of the street and the well, tales of the dead, the creation of the world and the sea, and talk of whether things exist or not. So that that cuts out a lot. This is advice to monks, you know. It doesn't necessarily. The rest of us, I suppose, can talk about villages and towns and cities. But, there's obviously, you have to look back at your intention. Because you want, there's a lot of social bonding that goes on with everyday chit-chat about the weather, right? And that's not harmful. So you can really look at your intention. But you can also begin to see, after a while, how tiring it is. Maybe to go through endless dinner parties where all you're talking about is what kind of computer do you have, you know, or something like that. It does kind of wear on you. So it can be really interesting to try to look at ways where you can bring up something that's really, you know, that's something that's important, something that it's possible to talk about skillfully with other people. It's not so easy, you know. There's not a general social permission to talk about anything but the modern equivalent of those topics. You know, what TV show, what device, what car, what food, you know, that's what people talk about. But it has a kind of emptiness that begins to be a little annoying after a while. What are you really learning about each other and your friends from only talking about that sort of thing? And there's an interesting practice regarding gossip that I have played with once in a while of really never talking about a third person. You know, don't talk about people that aren't there, or at least don't say what you wouldn't say to their face. You know, always remember that whatever you're saying could certainly come back to to them. And it's just as a practice, how could I put this so that I could actually say it to them, you know? So those are the basics of what's meant traditionally in the Eightfold Path by right speech. And of course, this applies to all media of communication. Email, texting is especially, it's so quick, it's just as quick as speaking out loud these days to type something and send it off. And I realize that I tend to send very terse emails. You know, I don't really like to type, so I type just a few words and send it off. And that can sound kind of harsh, you know. I don't really notice, oh, that I wouldn't say it like that. I'd cushion it if I were going to say it, but I just bam. And that's not very skillful, you know. So you've got to, I wish there were a button or some way to set on a computer a delay after you hit send. You know, 5 seconds later it comes back. Really? Haven't sent it yet. One more chance. You know, wouldn't that be great? You know, you could probably save a lot of trouble if that existed. So two other aspects of working with speech that are really important are silence and our listening skills. And they're related, right? So how comfortable are you with silence? Have you ever noticed? You know, what happens when you're, especially even by yourself, but with another person? What's the deal with silence? And that's so much what we're learning in the mental cultivation aspect, the practices of meditation, you know, concentration. We're learning how rich silence can be, what we can learn from that, how we can be comfortable with that, how we can really use it to center ourselves and see where our intentions are arising from. I've heard descriptions of certain Native American cultures where it's really part of the culture that each thing that's said arises out of silence. So somebody will say something and then there'll be silence. And then the next person says something, you know, and that's just the rhythm of that. When I have a friend, maybe some friends from the Dharma who are really quieted down, maybe we've just been on retreat or something and we're sitting there and we're trying to talk about something and we're really in that place where you have a minute to think what you want to say and you say it. And then the person thinks a minute, they take it in and they say what they want to say. That's a beautiful kind of conversation that doesn't happen very often.
Is that how the Quakers?
Well, maybe, yeah. I've heard a little bit about that. I think they do. They mostly sit in silence and wait for some inspiration to strike, and then they speak. And there's often meetings where the right kind of inspiration hasn't struck and nothing is said. And that's perfectly normal and fine, you know. So that's another way to, wouldn't that be radical? You just get together with some friends and, well, good night. Nothing up. You know, that's so true often enough, you know. That's how we really feel. There's nothing that urgent to say, nothing that really inspired to say. So really deepening your comfort with not speaking is a great help to the practice of speaking wisely when you do speak. You can become so familiar with the energy and the physicality of speaking. You know, where is it? What's the urge to speak coming from? And it's very related to the breath, of course. Also, the breath drives speech. So when you're listening, then, how deeply can you listen to what's being said, to what someone is speaking? Are you always rehearsing what you want to say next so you're not really listening? Are you waiting to cut in? And can you tune in to their, you know, more than just the words, but what's behind the words? Listen from your heart. Listen to their heart. Take in their whole body, their whole way of being. What's the underlying motive that you can detect in what they're saying? You know, they might be going on and on and on and on and on about something that isn't very interesting, but you can realize that the motive, maybe they're lonely, maybe they're, you know, frustrated, and maybe there's a way to connect a little deeper on that level by listening on that level. And another thing just to say is that there are different cultures with different ideas about this. I was talking to a friend the other day who's from some part of New York, and he was saying, well, it's very rude not to just cut in. You know, it's like you're not interested if you're not talking over each other's sentences and kind of jockeying to cut in. They're like, aren't you interested in what I'm saying? You're not interrupting me. So, you know, but I'm sure there's a way to do that in a good spirit, you know, like it's a game kind of, you know. That's, if you understand that that's the culture, there's probably a way to do it. That there are ways to do it that are harsh and rude and ways to do it that are just interested and fun. You know, I'm sure every culture has wise and compassionate people, and they must relatively have mastered the conventions of that culture in a way that convey those intentions. So, but it's just interesting. I did see a film once of groups of people from different cultures left to discuss, and boy, it was very different. One culture was cutting each other off like that, and the other culture was sitting there very quietly waiting their turn to say something. It was quite fascinating. So I thought we might, we have a few minutes to try some of this, so I thought we might get in groups of, I don't know, maybe let's get in groups of three so we can have a little time to do it, and maybe there might be one group of four if we're an odd number. So this is, it's really simple. It's not, I mean, we're not going to do anything except listen and talk about something that's not that hard to talk about. So, you know, no need to worry. So if you would get in groups of three, and it's a practice in listening and speaking. Okay? Okay. So go ahead and introduce yourselves if you don't know each other, and then let's come to silence for a minute. Okay? So let's come to silence, first of all. We're going to practice this idea of speaking out of silence a little bit. So we're not going to just all talk at once, but we'll go around one person at a time. We'll just offer a few reflections on the question that I'm going to ask. And the rest of you really practice that mindful listening. And what you can trust is that when it's your turn to talk, you have perfect permission to take a minute to think about what you want to say. So you don't have to think while the other people are talking. You can think when it's your turn. And then you can say something. And then if you only have one thing to say, you can go back into silence. So we're going to practice, or you can say something else, but you can practice really feeling where what you're saying is coming from. You know, kind of knowing that you're going to talk before you talk, and then talk, and then be quiet a minute and reflect, do I have something else to say? Oh, maybe I do. There's quite a difference between just catching a train of thought and going blah, 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 blah for several paragraphs without checking in with yourself versus saying something and then let me see how that's set and do I have something else to say? Okay, so just play with that a little bit. And the others in the group play with mindful listening while you talk. So the question is, which of these areas of wise speech, being truthful, being non-divisive, not being harsh, and not gossiping, which one is the most challenging for you? And what situations trigger you to not so wise speech? Okay, so that's the question. Yeah, which of these areas of wise speech, and you can take anything I talked about, but truthful, harsh, divisive, gossiping, or anything that comes to mind, some area of speech that is difficult for you, that's the most challenging, where you find yourself saying things you wish you hadn't, or in a tone of voice you wish you hadn't. Which one's the most challenging, and what kind of triggers, what situations and conditions tend to trigger you saying things you regret? Okay? So let's start with the person with the longest hair. just to make a decision for you, okay? And don't worry, just keep an eye, stay tuned into your body as you speak. Just try to see if you can know that you're speaking as you speak. More important than the content for this purpose of this exercise. Okay? So you can speak for about 3 minutes. You have about 3 minutes, and then I'll ring the bell and we'll go to the next person. Okay? Okay, let's come back to silence. And just feel the person who's been speaking, notice for a minute what it feels like to have been speaking. And the listeners might reflect on how well they listened, or were they distracted in some way? Okay, the next person, you can take the next longest hair if you like. Okay, coming back to silence. Just feeling the speaker, feeling what, how this is settling in your body. How did you, were you aware that you were speaking when you were speaking at any point? Listeners, were you aware that you were listening? Okay, and the third person can begin. Okay, just taking a moment for the third person to feel how that felt. And the others, how it felt to listen. And what your overall energy is after talking a little. Do you wanting to say more? Are you wanting to say less? Wishing you'd said less, more? What's your relationship to what happened? And let's come back together. Would anybody like to share a little of how that was? Was anybody able to really remember to be mindful while they were speaking? A little bit? Yeah? It's awfully hard, you know. Once you start going, then there you are on riding that wave. You're doing great if you can even occasionally realize that you're about to speak before you speak. Or even that you're going to pick up the telephone, or, you know, that's the moment when you can really bring to mind your intention and then see how long it can last into the conversation, you know. But it's really hard to realize that you're talking while you're talking and keep checking in with your body. Yeah. How was it to listen? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's very much part of our culture, is that you don't let people go on and on without somehow confirming what they're saying or, you know, expressing interest in some way. Yeah. It's a very interesting practice not to do that, you know, because sometimes it gives the other person some, in an environment where we've all agreed that those are the rules, you know, which it takes kind of in our culture to try this, but it gives the other person a chance to think a minute, you know, and maybe they get to direct the conversation kind of the way it internally goes for them, you know, and not always, we get, I don't know, there's a certain way that our culture is just so back and forth and so agreeing and so me too, you know, the way we talk to each other, and maybe out of silence something new would come up, you know, that would be a little different in what would happen next. So it's just an interesting thing to, you know, play with and try with each other. Well, let's just come back to sit for a minute or so and we'll conclude the evening. So may the benefit of our practice together this evening be shared with everyone we come in contact with, and then in ever-widening circles. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.